Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion.
All right, it's all about Burgerville. Burgerville Worker Union out in... Hello, this is Carl G. back with Mike C. on the board. Hi, Mike. Well, he's getting himself a beer.
Hey, Carl.
Or something.
Hey, Carl. No, hey, Carl. everything's running fine, buddy. Tell us about Burgerville. What the hell is it? And we got a special break. Hot news. Hot news, listeners. Go ahead.
This came out. I think yesterday afternoon is when we got word. And it made it up. I found it on the IWW website this morning. But Burgerville is a chain of restaurants. There's 50 of them between in the Oregon region. And yes, they went public a few years back. I think in 2018, and they got a contract recognized by the National Labor Relations Board. And so so there's more detail in that link. If you want to go ahead and play that, and I think maybe we can follow up with
breaking news from IWW.org by Max Barrow. The only legally recognized fast food union in the U.S. reaches a tentative agreement with a company. Upon ratification, workers at Burgerville will become the only fast food workforce covered by a collective agreement. Portland, Oregon. The Burgerville Workers Union, Industrial Workers of the World, BVWU, has reached a tentative agreement with Burgerville on a historic contract to be ratified by a vote of workers in represented shops. Upon ratification, workers at Burgerville will become the only fast food workforce in the U.S. covered by a collective agreement, a milestone in one of the longest standing labor disputes in the Portland, Oregon area. This agreement will set out a range of improvements in wages and working conditions for approximately 100 workers across 5 Burgerville locations. Burgerville and the BVWU have been in contract negotiations since June of 2018. Quote, a union and contract give workers more power at work, says Mark Medina, a member of BVWU bargaining team. Under the proposed contract, workers will gain access to a 3-month set schedule, paid vacation time, paid parental leave, improved job safety, and greater job security through just cause protections against arbitrary or unfair discipline. Those improvements, in addition to those already achieved by the union in preceding years, such as raises, tipping, free employee shift meals, and paid holidays, will be enshrined and protected in the proposed agreement. Quote, this is important for the future, for the kids, so they can have more money and work less hours, responded Rocca, a longtime worker at a union-represented Burgerville shop. This is also important for me so I can have a consistent schedule and have more money to support my family. Union organizers noted this agreement does not mark the end of their efforts to make improvements at Burgerville and in traditionally low-wage industries. We need real change in our society, and these improvements are just the beginning of new struggles to win even more, remarked Louise Brennan, an organizer with the union, adding, "For us, ratifying the contract is the first step to going on strike for better the day it expires. The vote will be conducted over the coming weeks at all unionized Burgerville locations. The BVWU hopes to have results from worker voting by mid-December. The Industrial Workers of the World is a labor union representing nearly 9,000 workers across North America. Established in 1905, the IWW is known for its high standards of democracy, transparency, multinationalism, and active use of the right to strike." Mary Meisenhall, BusinessInsider.com. Carl G. reading, "Nearly 3 in 4 drinks sold at Starbucks were cold last quarter, and it's great news for the chain. Cold drinks made up 3/4 of Starbucks sales this quarter. Cold drinks tend to be more expensive with customization options. Starbucks is investing in cold drinks with a new cold brew system and social media ordering. Starbucks just shared record-breaking earnings driven by the chain's popular cold drinks. 74% of drinks sold in the U.S. in the 3rd quarter, which ended up June 27th, were cold beverages. That was 13% higher than the previous quarter. Some of that growth can likely be attributed to customers preferring cold drinks in warmer months, and that's good news for Starbucks." The story's from MSN News. Mary Meisenhall, September 16th, 2021. "Fast food locations around the country are temporarily closing dining rooms for cutting hours. Owners say they can't open dining rooms without enough staff. The restaurant industry has faced a shortage of workers for the last year. Restaurant chains are going through another round of dining room closures, but this time it's not directly because COVID-19 infections. Chains are having to adjust hours or only operative drive-throughs as they face a lack of staff to keep restaurants running. McDonald's reminded franchisees of guidelines that would allow them to close dining rooms in areas with high rates of infection, and Chick-fil-A is allowing operations to keep them closed through January for safety, but many dining room closures across the country are actually a direct result of labor shortages. 3 Chick-fil-A restaurants in Alabama had to close their dining rooms over lack of staff, though they continued to make money for delivery. We, along with many businesses, are in the middle of a hiring crisis," the Alabama Chick-fil-A restaurant said in a Facebook post. A McDonald's location in North Carolina made a similar move, closing the dining room with keeping the drive-thru running. 2 more Chick-fil-A locations in northern Alabama have started closing early because of extremely short staffing, Grace Dean reported it for Insider. 2 campus Starbucks locations at the University of Alabama temporarily closed dining rooms due to limited staff and supply chain challenges, the Crimson White reported. Staffing issues are a problem across the country. In an August earnings call, Wendy's president and CEO told investors that some dining rooms were closing early and operating drive-through only because of lack of workers. The Dunkin' location in Colorado temporarily closed operations completely after it was down to only 3 workers, Zahara Tayyib reported for The Insider. "We're in a major labor crisis, and that's 100% reason why we're closed," Alex Apodaca, chief operating officer of JB Partners, the franchise said. "No other reason. JB Partners closed and reported 2 other Colorado locations this year over hiring issues. At least 2 Dunkin' Donut locations in Rochester, New York have also shortened hours, and a location in the Villages in Florida temporarily closed its dining rooms for several days. It's really tough times for staffing," Kalinowski Equity founder Mark Kalinowski previously told Insider. "Restaurant workers continue to quit the industry at record rates, moving to jobs where they don't have to interact with angry customers. To ward off potential closures, some operators have gotten creative by recruiting young teen workers and offering sign-on bonuses and hiring incentives." Starbucks workers across Western New York unionize. August 23, 2021. Starbucks workers across the Buffalo area are organizing a union. Starbucks Workers United sent a letter to CEO Kevin Johnson calling for him to sign a non-interference agreement. The SWU is made of nearly 50 partners from across the region working to create a better workplace. The group says many local employees have spent years serving up Starbucks, and respecting their right to organize will help improve their lives. "We are proud to announce that we have formed an organizing committee, Starbucks Workers United in Buffalo region. Here is our letter to Kevin Johnson, and this is off the SB Workers United Twitter account. Several local leaders have already voiced their support. There are at least 20 Starbucks locations in Western New York, and Spectrum News One has reached out to Starbucks for comment and is waiting to hear back. The Iroquois Starbucks page on Facebook, 1495 East Ridge Road, Rochester, New York, who would like to thank all you for being part of this journey. We couldn't do it without you. Our goal at the Iroquois Starbucks is to ensure that every customer receives unparalleled customer service. We will keep you up to date on all exciting things that are to come, and also would love any feedback you might have for us. We, again, just want to thank you all for being so amazing.
Yeah, this is an amazing story, and it's an example of working class power. So it takes about 8 years to get recognized as a union. So we saw Jimmy John's sandwich workers, Jimmy John workers in the Twin Cities. This was like 2005 or something like this when that started up. And so those are the first ones that I met, and the Starbucks Bucks workers in New York. And there's a funny thing is, Starbucks has so much power that the Wobblies in the Little Red Songbook has a song, "What Are We Going to Do with the Starbucks Bosses?" And that Starbucks is copyrighted, so the only way you can get it is actually to buy. You can't download it free, the song or the lyrics. So you have to actually buy it from the IWW.net or IWW.org for the Little Red Songbook. But no, that was my first experience at a Work People's College, was when the Starbucks workers got together to do classes, and the Jimmy John workers got to do classes. And I got to become good friends over the past 8 years, primarily because we're close to Minneapolis, and it was just the security and the secrecy. And getting a Wobbly to get hired, and they delivered sandwiches on bicycles. It's pretty dense. It's Twin Cities is pretty densely populated. And am I dead?
No, you're not dead. I'm listening. Everyone else is listening.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Go ahead.
All right. I'm skittish. I've been trapping feral cats all week. I'm a little skittish, but back to my story. So yeah, it was really a good Work People's College, retreat that year, and I'll always remember that. And with labor, one of the good things about the IWW. Is that it does it works slow. It works slow. Unions actually at this level work slow because this is you're not racing against time. Some people, everybody expects things fast, but building a union campaign really takes some. It starts out with a devotion of one person to convince another person that they should unionize. Because, a lot of these places, they have cameras everywhere. And Walmart contracts out union busting. So these are ex-CIA people that run Walmart's union busting operation. And like Target hire, they have like a huge, massive surveillance operation in their parking lot where they cover the entire street and actually sell data to like police departments and other marketing firms. So for this to be happening in the surveillance age shows you the power of that labor has. And it's a watershed event. I mean, so we've got like 9,000 people in the IWW now. So it's doubled in 8 years. Our Twitter page has 75,000 people. And so, yeah, I can't say enough about the IWW right now. So we're going to talk about Frank Little. And some people who may have read Howard Zinn might have come across Frank Little. Frank Little was actually born in Oklahoma. They'd moved to Illinois, but he grew up since the age of five, he actually grew up outside of Kansas City on the Osage River. And at the time, there were five IWW offices in Kansas City. And the first of the series of general strikes kicked off in Kansas City in 1918. And so there were 25,000 people, workers involved in that. So Frank Little was a merchant marine, and so there was actually an IWW on the Missouri River, what they call an IU, an industrial union. And he had a special talent. So he worked merchant marine, and he worked in the copper mines at Anaconda Mine in Butte, Montana. And he was a great orator, and to understand the soapbox network and what they called windmilling. There were free speech.
I missed that. What did you call it? Windmilling? What was it?
It's called windmilling.
Huh.
You know, like how a paper boy will like swing a paper here. Back in the day, you'd see him in the old black and white films. Well, it's somewhat like that. But what happened was, they would the Wobblies would get off a box car, and they would pack jails. And so they would stand on a stop on a soapbox, and they would swing their arm around like a fast pitch softball throw. And they as soon as they said fellow worker, they were arrested. And this was going on all around the world.
Yeah, I read about this. They called it one of the in the United States, I guess. Sounds like what you're talking about.
And this was an international phenomenon. The fight for free speech. And in 1916, there were 18 Wobblies that died of pneumonia in the Jackson County, Missouri jail. And of course, it's earmarked by being in a jail that Frank James spent the night in. But they really try. And of course, Kansas City, if Kansas City has one jail, there's two or three other jails that you don't even know about. That's part of the history of Kansas police.
Right. It's like Leavenworth. Leavenworth's that way too. Yeah.
Like our son Shane. Shout out to Shane staying out there. He's out in Salt Lake City this year. But yeah, Shane was arrested on one May Day, and this was 5 years ago. And they moved him to five jails. So we'd have to go in, go up to the clerk, give him a name, and a name and a birthday number. And he's not here. So that's how you know who a snitch is. Anybody who gets arrested in one of these events and they're out in 30 minutes. So I mean, you just learn that's the thing is working with labor, with radical labor like the IWW, you learn so much just by being with a bunch of Wobblies. You know what I'm saying? It's almost like osmosis.
Well, shall we listen to this 13-minute clip you took about Frank Little?
Yes.
All right, here we go, listeners.
This is an article about Frank Little by Rory Carroll in Butte, Montana, featured in The Guardian on Wednesday, the 21st of September, 2016, 7 o'clock edition. This is Carl G. reading the article. The mysterious lynching of Frank Little, activist who fought inequality and lost. The hobo agitator was killed in Montana in 1917. A century later, the question remains, who killed him, and did it help pave the way for Donald Trump? The murders parked in front of 316 North Wyoming Street shortly after 3 a.m. One stayed by the car while the others, six of them, all masked, entered the boarding house. They roused the owner, a woman named Nora Byrne. "We want Frank Little," they said. Terrified, she directed them to room 32. They kicked in the door. Their quarry, a slender, dark-haired man who had been sleeping. They hauled him out in his underwear, giving him no time to dress or grab his crutches, and bundled him in the car. They drove a short distance, stopped, tied him to a rear bumper, dragged him over the street's granite blocks. Out on Milwaukee Bridge, just outside of town, they beat him. Then they attached a rope to a railway trestle and strung him up. Cause of death, strangulation by hanging, said the coroner report. So ended the short, eventful life of Frank Little, labor leader, strike organizer, and anti-war protester in Butte, Montana, on August 1st, 1917. A crippled, one-eyed, itinerant activist, he took on a giant corporation and the U.S. government and lost. A century later, the mystery remains. Who killed Frank Little? The murderers were never identified. There are other puzzles. Was Dashiell Hammett, author of The Maltese Falcon, involved? What did the number 3777 pinned to Little's body mean? As the U.S. lurches towards the most toxic president election in living memory, perhaps the most intriguing question in this, did the lynching help pave the way for Donald Trump? That is a heavy historical load for an all-forgotten figure. In Butte, there is no statue or street named in Little's memory, not even a mention of him at the town's World Museum of Mining, just a few miles from the scene of his kidnapping. He lies in a pauper's section in the Mountain View Cemetery. In American history, he's barely a footnote, said Arnold Steed, author of a recent book on Little. If you're not reading someone like Howard Zinn, you're not going to come across Frank Little at all. Bernie Sanders or Occupy supporters never heard of Little. Yet a thread links his lynching to current battles over inequality, labor, mobilization, and blue-collar representation. The history of labor in America and the fight for recognition was such much bloodier than Europe's, said Aaron Gutfield. The history of labor in America and the fight for recognition was much bloodier than Europe's, said Aaron Gutfield, a historian who worked in Montana's mines and investigated Little's murder. Violence is as American as cherry pie. Frank Little grew up in the twilight of the Gilded Age. Corporate titans known as robber barons amassed fortunes on the backs of workers who toiled for meager pay and difficult conditions. Grand mansions coexisted with homeless camps known as hobo jungles. Little, the son of a Quaker, and according to Steed, part Cherokee, is thought to have been born in Oklahoma in 1879. After a stint as a miner, he joined the Industrial Workers of the World, a radical labor union known as the Wobblies. The nickname origin is unclear, but the organization's goal gleamed bright, a revolution to let workers in fields, farms, and mines keep what they produced. The IWW leaders and intellectuals, socialists, anarchists, Marxists were based in Chicago, but Little crisscrossed hamlets, towns, and cities in western states, agitating, recruiting, and evangelizing with little more than the clothes on his back, oratorical power, and a fearless bordering on suicidal. Frank Little preached to fruit pickers, lumberjacks, oil drillers, and miners, urging them to strike for better pay and conditions, and if necessary, to impede, to sabotage production. He drew crowds by standing on street corners reading the Declaration of Independence. He appealed not just to white working men, but women, blacks, Latinos, hobos, insisting they had common cause. Business owners hated and feared Frank Little. Newspapers denounced him and police jailed him. When that didn't work, the bosses hired thugs to beat him up, but that didn't work either. Little was a hobo agitator, fighting for freedom of speech and catching trains to flashpoints in Washington, California, New Mexico, anywhere where Frank Little could stir things up. The U.S. entry into World War I in April 1917 raised the stakes. Patriotic hysteria swept the country. The Espionage Act virtually criminalized any opposition as treachery. IWW leaders opposed the war, but hesitated to say so publicly. Little, in contrast, by then a board member, branded it a capitalist slaughter fest for which no worker should die. When soldiers rounded up hundreds of striking Arizona mine workers in June 1917, an enraged Frank Little denounced the troops as scabs. Weeks later, Frank Little headed north to America's industrial crucible, Butte, Montana. The Montana town set on top of the richest hill on earth, a font of copper which drew tens of thousands of miners. It had been known as the Gibraltar of unionism, with powerful unions and a socialist mayor. But by 1917, the aptly named Anaconda Company, a global player, was crushing organized labor. It controlled the employment, newspapers, police stations, politicians, and for good measure, had a militia, said Gutfield. In many respects, Montana at the time was a colony of the Anaconda Company. If you wanted to commit suicide, you went out against Anaconda Copper. A horrific accident in June 1917 killed 168 miners, infuriating survivors and giving the IWW, Little Hope, a chance to recruit. He arrived on the 18th of July. He was 38 years old and a physical wreck, thin, ill, a broken leg and a cast. Even so, he gave a barnstorming address to miners. Little spoke with maniacal fury and practically threatened the United States government with revolution. The pro-company Butte Miner newspaper reported, for 2 weeks, Little kept at it, urging miners to strike and fight the capitalists, but not the Germans. Newspapers demanded authorities crack down without gloves on such sedition and treasonable tirades. In retrospect, it was death foretold, but Little ignored warnings. Maybe he thought he could escape with just a beating. Maybe he knew what was coming. It would be better to go down slugging, he told his colleagues. There was one witness to the abduction besides Byrne, and there was no known witnesses to the lynching. A man called Robert Brown, on his way to work, found the body swinging from the trestle sometime after dawn. Pinned to his underwear was a placard. Others take notice. First and last warning, 3777. Rumors swirl to this day that Little was castrated, stabbed 27 times, lost his kneecaps from a drag whipping, that the numbers referred to his draft number or Montana's grave specifications, 3 feet wide, 7 feet deep, 77 inches long, that he was killed by Union rivals or a patriotic mob. The grisly details, said James Little Botkin, are exaggerations. He was savagely beaten and tortured, but didn't lose body parts and was likely unconscious when he was hanged. I believe they put him on top of the car and drove him out from underneath him. I believe they put him on top of the car and drove the car out from underneath him. He didn't struggle. He was strangled. The neck did not break. Little Botkin, more than anyone should know, the activist's great-grandniece, she spent 7 years combining official archives and plumbing family lore for a biography, Frank Little and the IWW. The blood that stained an American family. The retired teacher believes the numbers referred to a warning to vagrants to buy a $3 train ticket for a 7 a.m. stagecoach, as ordered by purported secret committee of 77 men in Helena, Montana. Little Botkin and other historians agreed the killers most likely worked for Anaconda. The company had armed thugs, private detectives, and police officers on the payroll, but would explain why the official murder investigation went nowhere. There's literally a subplot. In his youth, Dashiell Hammett, who created the fictional detective Sam Spade, worked for the Pinkerton Detective Agency, who specialized in strike breaking. Hammett's first novel, Red Harvest, concerns a labor dispute set in a thinly veiled version of Butte. In her memoirs, Lillian Hellman, Hammett's companion, and told her he was offered $5,000 to murder Frank Little. Through the years, he was to repeat the bribe offer so many times that I came to believe that it was kind of a key to his life. He had given a man the right to think he would commit murder. Some have speculated that the novelist actually did it. William Nolan, one of Hammett's biographers, thinks not. He didn't do it, but the fact that someone even asked him, thinking that he would be the kind of person and that he was that deep into the thing, made him feel guilty. He never got over it, and it always haunted him. Hammett subsequently became a communist and ended up on a McCarthy blacklist. Little's murder initially provoked flurries to defiance, but instead of galvanizing the movement, the lynching presaged a government crackdown. Federal troops in Butte, martial law in Spokane, the Federal Sedition Act of 1918, and the arrest of 165 alleged IWW members, all of its genius from improvising guerrilla tactics, noted the historian Robert Tyler. Members of Little's family were arrested, terrifying the family into decades of silence, said Little Botkin. If you had Frank's photo on you, that could be sedition. He had no photos of him, not one. The family just stopped talking about him. A movement which had mobilized the homeless and taught workers to take direct action never recovered, said Steed, the biographer. His death signaled the end of the only true radical and in some ways truly effective union of the time. Steed sees a continuum through the evolution and weakening of U.S. unions. Instead of a wide movement infusing white, black, and Latino workers with a shared class identity, unions narrowed and moderated their goals, seeking gains only for dues-paying members. Arguably, this was a sensible, successful tack which benefited members, but globalization and anti-union laws gradually drained their power. Only 1 in 10 American workers now belong to a union despite stagnant wages and widening inequality. Which brings us to Donald Trump. In the absence of powerful unions or a shared identity with the working poor and other races, blue-collar white men are Trump's strongest supporters. They feel angry and left out, so it's no surprise now that you have people willing to support someone who doesn't give a damn about them, says Steed. For C.W. Copeland, a Montana member of the IWW, which still limps on the fault lines not just with unions but also the Democratic Party and progressive academics, they neglected labor issues, he said. A lot of those going crazy for Donald Trump identifying more with their whiteness than their class. If more people knew about Frank Little, I think you have fewer voting for Trump. Perhaps, but Little's grave sits around yellowing grass and weeds in a lonely corner of the Mountain View Cemetery, drawing few pilgrims. Slain by capitalist interest for organizing and inspiring his fellow men, says the headstone. Cemetery signposts direct visitors to another grave, one adorned with flags and offerings. There rests Evel Knievel, the type of hero America remembers. This article was amended on the 10th of October, 2016, to attribute information about Little's heredity to his biographer, Arnold Steed. A Butte reader pointed out that Butte does remember Little with an annual gravesite commemoration, a sculpture at the Labor History Center in Butte, Montana.
Sorry about that. We were having some technical difficulties. This is Mike from the switchboard. We'll be right on. I'm going to put on some music, and we'll get Carl back on to take callers. Hold on to your hats. You never know what you get on Radio Free Kansas, the Abolitionist Hour. We'll be back on in just a minute. After this song, we were having some technical difficulties, and I'll be right back with you in just a minute after this song.
For the benefit of the tape back there, I would commit this song to the memory of a gentleman whose grave I visited yesterday over there on the island, Ginger Goodwin. We went over and put flowers on his grave. Fine and remarkable man. So let's try it. Where the Fraser River flows, each fellow worker knows, they have bullied and oppressed us, but still our union grows. And we're gonna find a way, boys, for shorter hours and higher pay, boys. And we're gonna win a day, boys, where the Fraser River flows. Fellow workers, pay attention to what I'm gonna mention, for it is the clear contention of the workers of the world that we should all be ready, true-hearted, brave, and steady, to rally round the standard when the red flag is unfurled. Where the Fraser River flows, each fellow worker knows, they have bullied and oppressed us, but still our union grows. And we're gonna find a way, boys, shorter hours and higher pay, boys. And we're gonna win the day, boys, where the Fraser River flows. All these gunny sack contractors have all been dirty actors. They're not our benefactors, each fellow worker knows. So we gotta stick together in fine or dirty weather, and we'll show no white feather where the Fraser River flows. Where the Fraser River flows, each fellow worker knows. They have bullied and oppressed us, but still our union grows. And we're gonna find a way, boys, shorter hours and higher pay, boys. And we're gonna win the day, boys, where the Fraser River flows. Now the boss, the law is stretching, bulls and pimps he's fetching, and they're a fine collection, as Jesus only knows. But why their mothers reared them, and why the devil spared them, are questions we can't answer where the Fraser River flows. Where the Fraser River flows, each fellow worker knows. They have bullied and oppressed us, but still our union grows. And we're gonna find a way, boys, shorter hours and higher pay, boys. And we're gonna win a day, boys, where the Fraser River flows.
Phillips, while we had a little technical problem there, but you didn't know about it because it was all on the switchboard, nothing to do with you, listeners. Thank you for calling in. Once again, area code 646-716-8652. The switchboard is open. Again, area code 646-716-8652. And Carl, there is a caller. He's a regular listener. Mark, he's a truck driver out of the Kansas City area. I'm going to put him on right now. Okay, Carl, are you ready?
Yes. Hello.
Here we go. Let's see if he comes
Welcome
on.
To the Abolition
I don't know. There you go. You're on air.
Okay. Yeah. Good. this is a little sounds like a hell of an individual. You know, but there's a lot of Mr. Littles out there. You know, I haven't got lynched or beaten up or anything. But there's a movement going on in the labor force that maybe you are aware of or not aware of. The American workers last month, over 4 million walked off their jobs due to wages, benefits, sick leave, family leave. And it's the biggest walk-off of job of employees off jobs in over 75 years. So there is a movement going on right now.
Well, how is this affecting the truckers? Are they feeling it? Are they starting to? Are you seeing solidarity broadly across the trucking industry?
Well, there's 80,000 positions open across the country, and we're shutting down the line of Congress. That's what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Railroads. Go ahead.
No, the railroad strike of. What was it? 1871 shut down half the country, and I remember the wildcat strikes in the early 70s during the Arab oil embargo.
Right.
And
yes.
And, well, and I was But I was a kid. I grew up around the trucking, and at one point in 1970 Nixon was bringing in the National Guard against the Teamster drivers in St. Louis.
Right. Yes.
That was one of the biggest strikes.
St. Louis, Chicago, San Francisco. Yes, Nixon did do that, but it didn't break it. We stood together in solidarity because we didn't think it was right that we were paying this extraordinary amount of money for diesel at that time that went from 85 cents a gallon to $1.15 a gallon. And now what we're doing now is that we understand that we have over 60,000 containers in San Francisco, off the coast of California, and they want to run us, work us to death to get this bottleneck of trailers moved, but they don't want to pay. And that's what's going on. They're running these truck drivers in and out because they need 80,000 more to make things smooth, but they're not going to get them. Why? Because it's capitalist trucking industry, J.B. Hunt, Schneider, I can go on, Swift. They didn't want to pay these men or women to drive these trucks and be away from their homes for 2 or 3 weeks at a time. And that's what the problem is right there. It's not going to get better. And what's going on and talking on, I don't know how closely connected to the American worker on the street. But right now on the street, it is general strike. France, 1968. That's what they're talking about. Not just the truckers. Not just the truckers. Everybody. Just shut it down. And bring them to their knees, and that's what's going to happen. That's what's going to have to happen. Bring them to their knees where none of the capitalists, none of the major corporations, none of these cities, counties, state governments are making any money because you can just shut it down. France did it in 1968. They shut down for over 2 months. And it brought the country to the knees. It brought them to the negotiating table. And they made a general union country, and that's what we have to. That's what's going to happen here. That's what's going to have to happen here, because right now you say union at any of these small, or not small, moderate corporations, they fire you. You can't even say the union the U word. It's like the fuck word. You can't. You just can't say it because they're fired. And until legislation is passed that will protect union organizers or people who want to invite the union into their businesses, as a worker, it's an uphill battle. But what needs to happen in this country is a general strike. And to get the federal government's attention and to get the corporation capitalists' attention that we, the workers, own them. They don't own us.
Yeah. Yeah, it's time we grab the bosses by the neck. Is that?
No, not by the neck. By the balls.
Okay.
We need to grab the...
We need by them con huevos.
Yeah, by the con huevos. If it's a female, you need to grab them by the, whatever you have to do to get the attention. You got to shut them down. You have to shut them down. But they can't, board of directors can't pay. There's no money going to the investors. When the investors aren't getting any money coming to them from the money they invested in the company, then people are going to start listening. If you do that like it is in France for 2 or 3 months, they're going to have a general union that will come in, a general union that covers any worker in the country, from garbage collectors all the way up to truck drivers, firefighters, whatever. You know, some people say, "Oh, that's socialism." Well, you know what? We're already a socialistic country.
That's right. Money and banking.
Yeah, society. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, yeah, money and banking is socialism. It's just the rich have socialism. And, you know, we got heartache and wine is what Utah Phillips says that we get.
80% of the working class people don't even know what fucking socialism is. They have no clue. All they know is what they saw on TV from the holiday. Socialism breeds communism. If you join a union, you're becoming a communist. Now, that's from the 1950s, and that's what these people understand. This is why these people, the forgotten ones, follow Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And Trump, who plays the card of, I'm an everyday American guy, I understand how the workers feel, I'll talk to you, so there's no, you know, I just tell them, talk to you in plain English. That's what he banned on. Basically, took these poor, I'm not going to call them stupid, but ignorant American workers who don't know any better, and made them feel like you're losing your rights and freedom. And that's what he convinced them, you know. If you don't stand up for this country, if you don't fight like hell, you're going to lose this country. So what?
Yeah.
I mean, I never understood that. I listened to your commentaries and the story about Mr. Little, and that is what the Trumpian people who surround ex-President Trump are scared of Mr. Little. That's what they're scared of.
And he fought for him. Frank Little was not afraid to die to work, not afraid to die for the proletariat, for the working man.
No, I'm telling you, sir. There's a lot of us out there. We're not afraid to die for what we believe in. But the thing of it is, it's a very common sense, common unity that the American worker has, but they just don't realize it. They have.
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
They don't see the power
that
organized labor.
Again, I'm going to go back to France 1968. That's the only way that we are going to get corporate America and the government of America to understand that we, the American workers, are the power of this country. Not a bunch of gun-blazing idiots that think that, oh, because this guy speaks plain English and he talks tough and wants to beat up black people and blah, 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 that's where we need to go. No. Donald Trump, because he knew what class of people need to touch with. Majority of the people in this country that Donald Trump touched are the majority of this country. You know, 85%. He got 71 million votes last year. And that's
mm-hmm.
something to say. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And what we need to do, workers, is unionize and get these people together. I'm behind Biden on this. Biden is a pro-union man. Is what that we need to basically grab corporate America by the balls and say, look, without us, you wouldn't exist. And that's true. And
mm-hmm.
that's what France did in 1968. It shut the country down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's not that long ago, but it's vanished down the memory hole of history. It appears. I mean,
well, people are afraid. because when it happened in France, you know, people didn't have money coming in. Individuals started contributing monies to a fund to help these people, help each other out, get the rent paid, buy them food, you know, and it's not going to be easy, you know, by no means, especially if we did it, if it happened in America. Corporate America would just shut, they would just shut down everything, you know, but the American workers will have the upper hand because it would basically be a, you know, what's the stare down, a stare down contest, see who blinks first, you know, and in France, luckily, the French workers, all the way from the garbage collectors all the way up to the doctors and nurses, they didn't blink. French government blinked and said, okay, we're going to recognize a general union, and that's what needs to happen in the United States. If you have a general union in the United States, they can go in with the power of the workers of this country and tell them, we want family sick leave. We want 30 days vacation every year. We want, that's what happened in France. They made these demands, and they were met. And it didn't cost the corporate French companies in France or the French government anything except raise the corporate tax to 35%. That's it. And here we are worrying about raising corporate tax 25% in this country. What the hell? Seriously?
Deregulation of the trucking industry broke the power of the truckers. This was, what year was that? 70, was it 75, 76? When
when they regulated trucking? 75. The thing with this, they had to regulate it because these corporations like J.B. Hunt, Schneider, Swift, they were just running they were driving the hell out of the truckers, the drivers, you know, keeping them away from home 3-4 weeks at a time, you know, making them run, you know, 15-20 hours a day, getting 4 hours of sleep. Politicians were using the truck drivers as slaves, you know, keeping them away from their homes. You know, and using their, you get to go home this weekend, but we need you to do this a little bit longer. They're using the home thing as a date, you know, and they had to regulate. And I'm glad they did regulate. You know, okay, you're only going to be able to drive 11 hours a day, you know, and you have to take a 10-hour break to get sleep. Because back in the day, no. You get sleep if you pull over and get sleep back in the day, you don't get paid for that. Nowadays, you get it needs to be regulated.
Now, have you been out to the port of Los Angeles at San Pedro?
No, I haven't. I quit doing OTR about 9 months ago. You know, but I talked to some of my brothers and sisters. They've been out there, and it's a mess. It's a mess. They're sitting in line for 2 to 3 hours just to get a goddamn container put on the back of the trailer, you know. And if they get smart with the crane operators, they get pushed to the back of the line. So they're spending all day out there waiting to get one goddamn container put on the trailer, you know. And these guys are not running the cranes out there making $300,000 a year, you know. I mean, it's just fucking ridiculous. Until they stop paying truck drivers a decent wage, decent money, and open up the highways to them, personally, my own personal opinion, you may not agree with me, but I really don't give a shit. They should open up 2 interstate highways going from coast to coast, open them up just to truckers, and shut it off to the rest of traffic. That's how you're going to end this bullshit. just tucks on those. That's the only way you're going to end this. Because the traffic congestion out there is just tremendous, man. It's ridiculous. And, you know, truckers, we're out there fighting, trying to survive and not kill anybody and get ourselves killed, fighting this traffic. You open up two main interstates, I-80 to the north and I-35, I-10 to the south, and just open them up to truckers only, you'll take care of the situation real quick. And just do it, not forever, but just do it for, 6 months. Okay, these two interstates, private traffic is not allowed on, just interstate trucking. And they'll take care of the situation.
That's interesting. Yeah, I between St. Louis and Kansas City is the most traffic of any interstate in the country.
I say,
I know. And I prefer driving at night.
I'm sorry to bump in, Carl and Mark, but I mean, Mark, you might clarify, you're still a working truck driver. You're just doing what they call a city route or an area route.
Yeah.
You're just not over the road. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I just wanted to clarify that.
No, I told them I hadn't been OTR for about 7 months. But I-70 is a total pain in the ass. But, fair it is, like I said, if you open up two interstates, I-80 in the north and I-10 in the south, and just make it restricted to just truckers only, you'll take care of this bottleneck in the shortage of products in our country, because they'll be able to get delivered. Because the biggest problem we have out there is the congestion. Getting out of L.A., it'll take you 2 or 3 hours to get out of L.A. or San Francisco or Santa Barbara. Just to get out on an open highway, Chicago. I ran in Chicago a lot, and same thing. For me to get from Chicago out on open interstate would take me 2 hours. If I was careful, I'd make it to my own base before I hit my 11-hour limit. And that's the big deal.
I've always heard this about truckers taking the back roads.
If you don't make the time, you take back roads, but you don't know what's going on with those back roads. Construction, it could be closed. You just don't know. Major interstates, on major interstates. But getting back to what we're talking about, the workers of the country, the workers of this country, we rule it. We definitely are the backbone of this country. And as your the commentary before we got back on this air stated, relating to Trump, that's the biggest capitalist dictator asshole there is. But he knew what to say and what to see. What did he call us? The forgotten ones. I don't know who the hell he's referring to, the forgotten ones. But if he's referring to the white working class people, I don't feel we were ever forgotten. I feel we were just suppressed. With the other Republican presidents in power, and Democrats, some Democrat presidents, never changed the law that any employee in any business has the right to organize a union without fear of retaliation, dismissal from the job. And that's the big thing I think. And I'm going to give it up to Biden. He's trying to get Bill 101 passed that will forbid that. We'll make a law that you can't fire an employee for the buying union. Been shot down twice by the Republicans, of course, but they're still pushing it. So we'll see what happens.
Well, I remember looking at Swift's package. This was like 2002. And, you know, you compare it to a job at Hardee's, and it was about the same pay.
Yes.
And, you know, because the medical was virtually zilch. And, you know, other than not paying hotel rooms, but you're still, you know, considering you're still paying your rent wherever your home base is, you know, at least Hardee's, you know, you're not just that stress of the road. You know, the responsibility of keeping that truck on the road.
It's still.
I
was making $72,000 a year on JP. Now, people think, oh, that's good money. Well, not really. Because when you break it down by the hour now, so I was home 2 days a week. So that means the other 4 days I was out on the road. You take 4 times 24. That's what?
4 times 24, that's about, that's like, what,
96 hours a week. Now, you break that 96 hours down to your out by an hourly rate. You're only making $20.25 an hour. That's what you make.
Mm-hmm.
No overtime. That's not overtime. Nothing. That's just straight time. They say, oh, you're getting good miles and blah, blah. Now, people, that's what some of them get. You can't fix stupid. You can't fix stupid. People need to look out by the hour, not by the miles, by the day, by the hours. Because those are the hours of your life that you're giving up to this employer to provide a service.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why we need a union, to break it down by the hour. People mm-hmm. think, oh, you're making good money. Well, yeah. I have a friend of mine, he makes great money, sure. $85,000 a year. But he's only home 4 days every month.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right, so let's break that down by the hour. So we did. He's making $10.15 an hour.
Wow. Yeah. It's a fact. Working 120 hours in 1 week will kill you. I mean, that's not.
See, but you understand something, brother. They don't think go be a truck driver. You're just sitting on your ass steering a truck. You're not working. You're just sitting on your ass. That's the way these fucking corporations look at it.
Mm-hmm.
They don't understand that. They don't understand the mental stress you're going through, driving for all the traffic, the physical stress you go through, and the home and stress on your home life. They don't care about all that shit. They don't give a rat's ass. They want to make sure we have a saying in the fucking trucking industry. If the tires aren't rolling, you ain't making money.
We're going to take a break. It's getting good here. Carl, do you mind if I pick up a Utah Phillips song and we'll come back? And we'll come back with Mark, the truck driver. Brother Mark is a very interesting guy in his experiences out there on the road. He's a regular listener of Radio Free Kansas during the week. But let's have a musical break, and is it okay we bring Mark back on, Carl?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, that's great. This is a good show to talk about labor issues.
Well, here's what's funny. I think everybody who listens to this show is going to go wild over you.
Another one of T-Bone Slim's songs. play, go wild, simply wild over me. Although I've never done them harm that I can see. I'm as gentle as a lamb, but they take me for a ram. They go wild, simply wild over me. Oh, the cop, he went wild over me. And he held his gun where everyone could see. He was breathing rather hard when he saw my union card. He went wild, simply wild over me. Then the judge, he went wild over me. And I plainly saw we never could agree. But so I let the man obey what his conscience had to say. She went wild, simply wild over me. Then the jailer, he went wild over me. When he locked me up and threw away the key. Oh, it seemed to be the rage to keep me in a cage. He went wild, simply wild over me. Now they go wild, simply wild over me. I'm referring to the bed bug and the flea. Oh, they murmur in my sleep. They disturb my slumber deep. They go wild, simply wild over me. Will the roses grow wild over me when I've gone into the land that is to be? When my soul and body part in the stillness of my heart, will the roses grow wild over me? Well, and God, he went wild over me. Oh, when I knelt beside the throne on bended knee. Oh, when the angels heard me yell, they shot me down to hell. But they went wild, simply wild over me.
Our favorite Utah Phillips recorded in Manhattan, Kansas, way back there. And we have live on air Carl G. He's the host. He runs the show. He prepares all this wonderful news clips and stuff about the Burgerville Starbucks organizing efforts of the IWW, Industrial Workers of the World. And we also have on air Mark. Brother Mark is a truck driver, and he used to do OTR, over-the-road driving. And he has some rare insights into the labor conditions of truck drivers. And so we're going to return to Carl G. and Mark. Brother Mark, I have one question I'd like to ask you, only, and I don't want to take over the mic. I just want to ask you this. Could you tell us what you think of the effect of the truck driving industry with the, you know, the so-called, was there a shutdown? When the pandemic happened, I noticed that there was like, you know, everywhere in the world, all the workers just stopped. Hey, I'm not going to go get this disease, and it really just sort of effectively shut down the whole world. I mean, everybody just sort of shut down. I think the truck drivers are still running, and correct me if I'm wrong. But they were running under some incredible problems, and you ran into some problems out on the road. I remember you telling me months and months ago about the problems you were running into among other truck drivers about wearing a mask and just basic scientific things. Can you talk a little bit about that? And then I'm sorry, Carl, to interrupt it, but he's got some funny stories. Brother Mark has some funny stories about. Carl, I'm sorry I won't do that to you again. We may. We're in the second hour, by the way, listeners. I don't know if you noticed, but we're now. We're going to have to change the name. It's the Abolitionist Hour. I don't. It's up to you, brother. But we're in the second hour, and we are still taking callers. Yes, thanks to the Blog Talk Radio Network. Area code 646-716-8652. You can still call in. We're now expanded Carl's show to 2 hours every Saturday night, beginning at 7 o'clock Central. And I just want to give the mic back to Carl and Brother Mark. Mark, there were some funny stories you had to talk. I mean, people were getting pissed at these different freight terminals that you would go and work at about wearing a goddamn mask. I guess it was a pistol for this.
Oh yeah, yeah.
you know, back in the beginning of the pandemic, was because of the shutdown for us truckers, that was great. No traffic. It was fantastic, you know. But when you pulled into a truck stop and it said mass quiet, oh, holy crap. You figured you were getting castrated. Some of these guys thought it was like, I ain't wearing no damn mask. And, you know, and why? Well, it's all, you know, a lot of them would say it's all conspiracy. It's Democrats pushing this conspiracy theory. It was the poor Asian truckers, they wouldn't get out of the trucks. You know, because they get out and feel the trucks, they're worried about getting beat up. You know? It was crazy. It was just crazy out there. For me personally, I thought it was great because there was no traffic. I would go into Chicago and maybe see two or three cars, you know, at the beginning of that pandemic. But the other, this is no way to call it. I mean, you got to call it the way you see it. These are people that were saying that this is all make believe and, you know, and refuse to wear masks. I went to this one truck stop, and there was some truckers that weren't going to wear masks. And, of course, the establishment people told them, well, you can't come in. It got pretty heated, and they had to call the police then. You know, I'm sitting in my truck, and I see all these goddamn cop cars pull. I go, what the hell? And it's because some of these guys, they were, I mean, there's no way to put it. There were diehard Trump supporters that refused to wear a mask. And matter of fact, they were screaming, the president's not wearing one. Why the hell should I have to wear it? You know?
Trump. Yeah, because I was watching the Detroit Pistons. We were in Detroit, and we watched the Detroit Pistons. And that their main player for the Utah Jazz came down and tested for COVID the next day. And I was just thinking about this. It's like, this is the last time we're going to be wearing a mask for a long time. And that was March of 2020.
Oh,
and we're 18 months through this. And we got another wave coming of this one.
Yeah, we're going to be wearing masks for a while. That's acceptance. You know, until people get vaccinated, and the majority, when 3/4 of the country gets vaccinated, we're going to be wearing masks for a while. But I was telling you, back on the truckers' end of the deal, there's only a few of us truckers out there that are liberal Democrats that, I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't put label on it like that. There's a few of us truckers out there that believe in science. Yeah, we believe in the science. And we understand that this is not it killed 720,000 people. This is not make-believe. It's not made up. It's real. But there's just a few of us. The majority of them thinks this is all made up. And it's just another way the government's trying to take our freedom away, our rights away, whatever the hell that means. And the ones that don't believe in unions or organized labor movements or, they think of themselves. That's the best way to put it. They think of themselves. They don't think of their fellow humans or their fellow people, man.
Well, I've tried to get you to tell a story, but I'm sorry.
What
Carl,
story you want, Mike?
About
what
my
story
in Chicago. It's a good
Chicago,
it's a great story. And you know, what can one worker do, I mean, to screw things up and at the same time apologize after it all happened? I mean, it's Mikey in Chicago at that freight terminal that you told me on air was hilarious. Could you talk about Mikey in Chicago? So I think he's actually probably a nice guy, but, I mean, he's a Trump guy. I don't know what he is. But
he used to be a Trump guy, but he's a hospital guy. But Chicago Mike, that's what we called him. I'm not going to say his last name, but I called him Chicago Mike. He was so tied. Coronavirus. He that was just ridiculous. Yeah. And I think the story Mike is relating to is that when he finally caught it, you know, and then he apologized to me personally about the coronavirus, the COVID. And I said, I'm glad you don't have to apologize. I said, I'm just glad you believe it really exists.
Mm-hmm.
But in his heart, he was a very good person. It's just, you know.
Well, when you're surrounded by disinformation, like we've seen, you know, especially the last 25 years, how does someone get out of that bubble? It seems like COVID is breaking that bubble.
Right.
Better than anything that we've seen.
But here's what's really kicking the ass. He's a union. He's a Teamster. Yeah.
Wow.
Chicago Michael's a Teamster. He's a what? Excuse me, I shouldn't say. He's a Italian. Yeah. From the north side of Chicago. And he's a Teamster. And he would complain about J.B. Hunt day in and day out. You know, but when the COVID hit, it was, you know, well, you know, J.B. Hunt was doing anything right but making the essential workers, you know, which I guess we were. But he spoke, the way he talked about, you know, COVID-19 is all made up. It's not really real. You know, then he finally caught it and realized it was real. He was just one of those old school Teamsters. You know, this guy, his dad was a Teamster. His grandfather was a Teamster. You know, been in Chicago trucking and the trucking industry for years, you know, for generations. And it was just so
I remember during the Vietnam War that, because I lived on a street where everybody was a Teamster trucker, and there were teenagers that told their dad that they weren't going to Vietnam, and they were knocked out on the spot. And that is a common story back in the late 60s and early 70s. They were,
right.
You know, man, they, you know, Nixon right or wrong, or Nixon now, I don't remember what the slogan was.
Yeah, same thing. The same thing with these old truckers now. You know, Trump is, you know, he's the man. He's going to take this country in the right direction. And what's really funny that they didn't realize it, or they were just ignorant, you know, that Trump was anti-union, of course, and that's what was, I think, Mike is referring to, is that Chicago Mike couldn't see that Trump was anti-union, and he was a Teamster. And that was the ironic severity of the whole situation, is that he's mm-hmm. speaking about how J.B. Hunt should be unionized, but he's supporting Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
The irony is just beyond me. You know, and that's what a lot of the majority of truckers feel. Well, they're pro-union, but they're pro-Trump. You know, and they don't realize that Trump, Nixon, were anti-union. They didn't want union. The unions were hurting, were the evil of our capitalism society that we live in, understanding that the wealth that these corporations make off the sweat and the back of the workers should be brought down and put back into the company, the corporation, to improve the lives of the workers. No, they don't care about that. Now, I mean, I've worked in a lot of different companies. I work for one now that thinks the same way, you know. And,
mm-hmm.
It's the only way it's going to change, and Brother Mike here, this is the only way this is ever going to change. This is going to be a general strike, which we are basically going through now. Like I said, last month we had 4.8 million people that quit their jobs. You know, right now there's a labor shortage because people, you know, these companies say, oh, we just can't get people to come work for us. Well, no, because you're not employee friendly. You don't want to pay them. You don't want to provide them benefits, family sick leave. I mean, look what happened in Washington with the Build Back Better plan, with the family with the family sick leave bill. You know, Manchin and Sinema, who are both supported by, you know, Manchin by the coal industry, and Sinema by the petroleum industry, should shut this down because they don't want that to come in. They don't want this bill back, America better. The subsidy
mm-hmm.
bill
mm-hmm.
to help the American workers. No, because corporations are afraid. Oh shit! If a man's wife gets pregnant, his wife mm-hmm. take care of the newborn kid. I mean, this is not a labor-friendly country. It's
mm-hmm.
at all. You know mm-hmm. this. I mean, you're wobbly for crying out loud.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. That's right. I mean, the labor wars in the U.S. were the bloody wars, and we can't forget that. And it was because of the power of the unions beginning at the turn of the century. You know, the railroad strike, 1871, and, you know, the fight for the 8-hour day, you know, it led us into World War One, you know, and of course that's Frank Little was lynched when he went anti-war.
Mm-hmm.
And, but only labor can save the planet. Organized labor can save the planet because labor creates all wealth.
Yes,
labor is entitled to the wealth that it creates.
I agree 110% with you, but Carl, you touched on something I think that is very interesting in your talk about the Burgerville and Starbucks strike, about the what some people call the corporate surveillance state. And Mark has has something to offer about how the corporations even watch minute to minute what truck drivers do on the road. I mean, this is really serious stuff, Carl, what you're talking about. I know you know that, but
mm-hmm.
I mean, I just want the listeners to understand that this is everywhere, even in the trucking industry, how they watch everything the workers do. And I'm sorry to,
That's right. And the Federal Transportation, they have their own surveillance of trucking, right? Because you see them all the time over at the weigh stations. Is that right?
No.
Those things that, huh?
No, it's all at the weigh station. They have a thing that on you have what they call an electronic log. You log in, and it records when you're moving or when you stop. Hell. They didn't even know when I pulled the side of the road to take a piss. You know, I mean, excuse my language, but I mean, they'll ask you. Well, you pulled over here. You were there for like, you know, five or 10 minutes. What were you doing? You know, I was going to the bathroom, man. They know that. I mean, this is how they catch it. I mean, this is how serious they are about making sure that that truck and trailer are moving. They don't want you doing that. Or can't you just piss in a bottle or something? A lot of drivers do that, you know, because they don't lose their jobs. You know, and it's not a, like I said, when it breaks, if you break down a $60,000, $70,000 a year job, and you break it down into hours, how many times you are on that road, it really is. It's only like $10.25 an hour. You're like, Not that. Yeah. Everybody says, "Oh, you're making big money." No, you're not making big money. So, well, yeah, you are, but what sacrifices do you make that big money? You know, how long are you willing to be away from your family? How long are you willing to sit down behind that wheel of that tractor trailer and push it? You know, they don't understand that. But when you take it down, you break it down to by the hour, right? And let's say you're going to make $70,000 a year, you're going to make $10.25 an hour. That's what you make. Bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because you're looking at, you know, you're looking at, $90,000 a week, you know. Just do the math.
Math don't lie. So if there's a shortage of 80,000 truckers, that means there's like a shortage of 160,000 truckers.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, because nobody should have to work 96 hours a week.
No. There's a way to get around it, you know, and they don't want to do it. Trucking industry don't want to do it. Trucking industry, instead of hiring, you know, and doing runs and sort of like the Pony Express, you know, you ride.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to do it because they have to hire more drivers, and you're going to cut into their profit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's take one truck driver and make him run, you know, for 11 hours and take a 10-hour break and then run 11 more hours, take a 10-hour break and run 11 more hours. Oh, by the way, that 10-hour break, you don't get paid. You don't get paid for your sleep time being away from home, although you're sleeping in a truck, eating shit food, you know, and doing what I had to do, give me a 5-gallon bucket and go to the bathroom. You know, I mean, people don't realize how rough it is now. It's not, a, you know, oh, you pull in a truck stop, it's full, waiting to park at. You can't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is what people don't realize about truckers. You know, we do some pretty barbaric things just to do the job. You know, now I'm not exaggerating.
Well,
not going back.
No, it was like
five-gallon bucket.
What I remember about the Jimmy Hoffa movie with Jack Nicholson and Danny DeVito was that Danny DeVito's fingers were burnt, and that's how he stayed awake. Was keeping a cigarette, you know, lit.
Keeping a cigarette burning, yep. True shit.
Yeah.
These corporations, these big major trucking companies, and it goes right, you know, the trucking corporations are the bottom feeders. They're the bottom. I mean, they are the bottom feeders of corporation, of the corporate chain. You know. And they're getting the crumbs from the effort, you know, Walmart, Amazon, all these other assholes. They're getting the crumbs to move their product. So they're going to abuse and take advantage of the truckers, the drivers, because that's their employees. That's what they do. You know, and so instead of doing, like I said, the Pony Express thing, one guy goes so far, stops, another guy picks up a chair and goes so far. No, because now they're going to have to spend more money. They're going to let this one guy pay him $10.25 an hour to take something from San Francisco to Kansas City and just wear him out and be away from his family for two weeks at a time. You know? And if I'm away from home, I need to be paid for it. I don't give a shit what it is. If I'm not home, sitting on my ass at my kitchen bar, drinking glasses of Chardonnay, I need to be paid for it. Bottom line, I don't care if I'm sleeping or what. But
no, it's worth. You should. Be, yeah, I would. I think four days on, 4 days off would. You know, at the same pay. Or better.
Yep. That's the same pay. If they did that 4 days on, 4 days off on the same day, you would get a lot more people getting into the checking test. But that's not the way it works. You know, they run us like, like I told you, just break it down, 70,000 a year.
Here's what I remember about the brochure from Swift is that Patch and I on Interstate 40 going around Gallup, New Mexico.
Yeah.
Where you can just see it's amazing. And I don't know, it's almost like, you know, military intelligence wrote that manual, you know. Because that was kind of the same thing that the Army recruiter would sell you. And a life of adventure and this and that. That's the only way to survive in most Midwestern towns right now is to drive a truck. And these trucking outfits know it.
This is true. And so here's the deal. I'm sitting here, I'm doing the math again, and it comes up the same. $10, 25 cents an hour. That's what you didn't pay. For $70,000, driving 120 hours a week. That's what you get paid. $10.25 an hour. So I might as well go forward to fucking Walmart and make $15 now.
It's interesting, you know, because like the Chinese, they say we don't have enough ports in the United States to ship goods. But then again, it's like there's on the other side, there's 80,000 labor shortage in trucking.
Uh-huh.
Maybe we need to start hitting the truck stops and putting out flyers for a general union. Do you think that would help? Just get some.
I think if you put out the stops for general union, 4 days on, 4 days off, you get a lot of people signing up for it. A lot. And it would definitely take care of this bottleneck at the ports where we have, right now we got 72,000 detainees sitting in L.A., of goods that need to get transported across the country. We've got 65,000 on the East Coast sitting in containers off coast. That's not the ones in the port. That's the ones on ships. They're saying, it's truckers. Well, yeah. Yeah, it is us. I'll admit that in a minute. Because there's just not enough of us. The ones that are here are wore out. you can only do so much.
We have a wobbler who passed away who talked about organizing a truck port in Philadelphia. And he said it was the easiest thing. He said it took like 3 months of putting just flyers out before they started having organizing meetings and got a union.
See, the thing of it is, organizing unions, great, but you got to go all the way up to DOT. DOT needs to change the regulations. Yeah. DOT needs to step in and say, okay, this is not working. Department of Transportation is the one that set the guidelines, the regulations on it, driving hours of duty, hours of operation. And then you also put in the hours of operation, days of operation. You can only be on the road 4 days. 3 days would even be better. You can only be on the road 3 days. After 3 days, you got to take 4 days off. Then you cannot get back in a commercial vehicle for 4 days. And that would definitely take a big load and stress off the truck drivers. But it's going to be a big stress and financial burden on the corporations, because that means, oh, shit, we're going to have to hire more truckers. Yeah. And pay them the same that they're getting paid now. We're going to pay $70,000 a year. You're going to be on the road for 3 days, and you're going to be home for 4. And that's it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That would take care of it. Right there. Plain and simple. 3-4. 72 on, 120 off. And that would take care of this problem. Because
mm-hmm.
We're only humans. We're not machines. You know, we're not just a piece of meat on a steering wheel. You know. And we have families. We have loved ones we want to be with. And the mood now is a lot of truckers are realizing this. You know, this is bullshit. But they're not going to do anything because the regulations of DOT is for the corporations. It's not for the truckers.
Mm-hmm.
The DOT says, oh, well, yeah, you only have to drive 11, you get 10 off. But the corporations say, okay, well, we'll just keep some of the bitches out there for fucking 2 weeks. We'll follow the regulations. You feel
mm-hmm.
what I'm saying?
Yeah. 4 days. 4 days on. 4 days on. 4 days off.
Would be fair. Would be completely fair. And that's when the Department of Transportation needs to step up and say, "This is the deal." You know, because I have friends that were worked for Schneider. They said, "Oh man, I got a great job at Schneider. We're going to make $85,000 a year. Good for you." And they sent them out to the West Coast, and they wouldn't be home for 2 months, 3 months. You know, they say, oh, you know, they say, well, hey, they didn't come home. They say, no, we need you to pick up this trailer. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And if they didn't do it, they got fired. You know.
Well, what about Werner Trucking? Because every time I see a strike breaking, there's always a worse. Yeah.
One, J.B. Hunt are the two of the worst, and Yellow Freight. Those are the three worst trucking companies in the business. They will run their drivers to death. You know, they don't care. Because they say, well, they do now, because back in the day, they say, well, if you just quit, we'll just hire another driver. But nowadays, times are changing. Because nowadays, that's not the way it works. Yeah, we'll just hire another driver. Well, no, you won't. Because the younger people, the younger drivers that are getting hired, they're smart. They're figuring this shit out. Oh, wait a minute. You know, they'll do the math and then the numbers. Say, well, no, man, I ain't going to do that for $1,000 a year. I'm only making $10.25 an hour. Bullshit. Now, please don't take me, please do not take me wrong here. The biggest problem we have in the trucking industry is we are, how can I put it without sounding big? We have a lot of international company trucking industry that will do it because it's a lot of money for them. They come from the Salt Lake nations, or from the African nations, or Middle East nations, and that will do it. You know, the problem is they're not safe. They can hardly read English, but basically speak it. And I'm not putting them down. I'm not against them whatsoever. But
what I'm understanding is like. In Mexico, the trucks can come into the United States, but not have the same regulations as a truck that's licensed in the United States. Is that correct?
That's true. That's correct. Mexico and Canada, if they're licensed and tagged in Canada or Mexico, they do not have to follow the guidelines of the United States DOT regulations. That's correct. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. Well, there's certainly people in the CNT making attempts to get labor organizers into Northern Africa and into the Middle East. And you know, there's so much war.
The Teamsters need to pants up, put the big boy pants on, and go out there and tackle this. You know, and shut the trucking industry down for a week. Just shut it down.
We have a UAW retired person here in Kansas City, and he was hospitalized twice for talking about a general union, as you're describing tonight. This was in the 70s.
Yep, that was pretty heavy back then. But nowadays, it'd be more welcome and a lot more participation from the truckers. If you're talking about just a general union for the trucking industry across the United States, I really feel it would be welcome with open arms and listen to the listen to them what the advantages it would be to have a general union, general truckers union, not, you know, call them teams as well, you want to call them, but just for truckers, a union just for truckers, all truckers, not just individuals, corporations, all truckers across the United States, and get enough that you could lobby the DOT change the regulations to a 4-day off.
Hey, Mark.
Off.
Hey, Brother Mark. Mm-hmm. Brother Mark, I think we got another guest. Come on. If you don't mind, we're going to put Lamar. Lamar, he's a regular caller. He wants to come on, and he's got some things to talk about, too. Is it all right, Carl, if I bring Lamar on?
Yeah, hey, Lamar. All right, thanks, Mark. And call back, and we'll talk again about this and see if we can get some organizing plans together and start getting some information out to these truckers out here at these truck ports. Thank you, Mark.
Lamar, you're on the air.
Hey, what's going on?
Hey, Lamar.
Cool. Hey, yeah, that was it was great. Appreciate it, Mark, for for getting on and the dialogue and everything, you know, y'all doing phenomenal, you know, I'm really inspired, you know, by figures like Frank Little and individuals who stand up and resist, who choose to do that, you know, and and leave a legacy of inspiration, you know, and regardless of whatever ropes, so, you know, I try to choke that voice or, prison walls that try to silence that spirit of resistance, you know, it still has a way of resonating throughout generations. We're freedom fighters everywhere. So, yeah.
It's just below the surface is what people realize, because like a lot of times they find it through Howard Zinn. You go to places like Minneapolis and they remember the strikes, the auto strikes in 1932.
Yeah.
And you know, it's still oral history in a lot of places.
Yeah, and you know, like even before that, you know, like yeah, you know, like it was just a lot, you know, just it's a lot, you know, when the walkout happened following the 1917 disaster that, you know, claimed the lives of 160 miners in Montana, you know, that crippled copper production, you know, that's particularly substantial because that was at a time when America was entering, you know, the First World War. So, you know, that was that was substantial. And you know, the strike, it was like a month in progress when Frank made his way to it on crutches, you know, after, you know, getting jumped on by the union busters a few weeks earlier, you know, and he raised the mercury level and the thermometer of resistance with the inflammatory speeches he gave to the workers, and, you know, he was like on fire, you know. So, yeah, you know, he was dynamic, and there was a lot, you know, there was a lot more labor resistance than, you know, a lot of things going on. So that the fear of resurgence, you know, going on is, you know, it's something to, you know, it's something to think about, and something to get, you know, to rub your head and get enthusiastically involved with, you know, because so much is going on now that, you know, it's the, where people could learn a lot from revolutionaries like Frank Little and people who maybe never even had a revolutionary consciousness or anything like that, you know, and who may be in a sucky job and, I'm about to start another factory job on Monday. It's like, I don't know how many factory jobs I don't work, you know, and it's so I'm just getting ready to see what's going to be the hats with that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, figures like Frank Little, you know, make a huge impact on, on working class history, you know, that often go overlooked, and a lot of us who stand on the shoulders of giants like Frank Little, you know, will benefit a lot from reading his story, knowing his story, and listening to podcasts like this to sit back like, wow, I'm saying, you know. So yeah.
Yeah, and what they were mentioning was Bixby, Arizona, where they put like 1,500 miners in a boxcar and left them out there by Texas Canyon in southern Arizona to die of dehydration.
Yeah, it's sick. You know, it's a stifling atmosphere. It's literally class war, you know, like where lives are at stake. You know, a lot of bodies get swept under the rugs, you know, their stories, and, you know, things are still, you know, happening to this day, you know, but, it's shit, man, you know, so it takes this kind of solidarity, you know, union organizer, you know, revolutionary union organizer, you know, to really, you know, band together and to, you know, crush things and, you know, like economic exploitation due to, you know, the colonialism, the neocolonialism and the things that's going on and the imperialism and the, you know, it takes a unified struggle, a unified effort. You know, more and more folks is waking up to this fact, you know, is waking up to it, especially like, you know, with the, you know, after the pandemic and everything, and, you know, so it's
we have to have a vision of something better over that hill.
Yeah. Yeah. The vision,
we can't let this, go ahead. No, we can't let this break us.
Yeah. No, like, you know, that vision is a shared vision. Once you know, the more folks, you know, see the commonalities that we have, you know, that, you know, and learn more about working class struggles, working class, you know, our story, learning more about dynamics, you know, striking, the power of the strike, you know, the general strike, You know, it's just like in prison. You know, when one person goes on a strike, a work strike or whatever, they make the person look like a nut. You know, and throw them in a hole or whatever, you know. And but when you got, you know, when you got a whole cell block, or more than that, like a whole prison, you know, where at least a substantial amount of it, let alone, you know, a whole community of resistance in workplaces everywhere, you know, in different places, here and there, you know, and in different factories and shops, and places that produce the things that we ironically pay for, you know. As when more and more people start scratching their heads and thinking about these things, the closer we get to collectively cracking our knuckles and generally striking, you know, and crushing this thing, you know, and this, you know, we have the ability, we have the ability not only in the factories and in the workplaces and all that, where the workers outnumber the bosses, you know, but also in the hood and in the streets, you know, where the people outnumber the police in every city and metropolitan area, 1,003, you know, by the most, 1,006. That's something you could look that up in the almanac, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So when we do the math, we see how strong our potential is, you know, and solidarity and study make for a powder keg of potential, you know. So
and
the more we have, excuse me?
No, okay, go ahead. The more we have?
Yep. Yeah, so, you know, and the closer you get to blowing the lid off the stand, you know, and becoming free, you know, and learn, and when we learn about things like collectives, building collectives and working collectives, you know, and learning about how things were done in the past, you know, and what mistakes not to make in the past, you know, the closer we'll become to it. I'll be in the hood organizing. So, you know, passing out literature, doing, you know, talks in the hood, and, you know, in the streets, you know, and more folks in the hood, I'm talking about, like, people in street organizations, you know what I'm talking about, you know what I'm saying? So people in street organizations is becoming aware, because a lot of people, you know, whether they disciples, blood, whatever, you know, they're becoming hit. Because they're going through it. They're going through, you know, working for temp agencies that, you know, paying a certain amount, and they have to resort to temp agency work because they're getting out of prison and can't get another, it's hard for them to get another job. And they treat it like, you know, like pieces of, you know, feces, you know what I'm saying? And, you know what I'm saying? And people's getting paid for things that they know they should own. You know, so, you know, it's like the housing that, you know, we rent, you know, that we pay rent for. You know, it's our class that builds these homes. Why do we gotta pay to live? Why does our class have to pay to live in them? You know, so when we have these kind of dialogues, you know, in the streets as well as in the in the workplaces, you know, and things like that. You know, it's And more and more people get involved. You know, they just got another recruit, you know, yesterday. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, he missed the cell. I don't know if the listeners can know what I'm talking about, but he missed the cell in the streets, you know, with his homie, you know what I'm saying, to vibe on this kind of conversation, you know, and join the movement, you know. So, the more and more people learn about the dynamics of capitalism, what it is, the more, you know, the more people become more and more disenchanted with the idea of selling out, you know, of selling poison to, you know, our people for economic gain and things like that, or working for a system, you know, that just isn't working for us.
Well, we're wrapping up the show, and we've been talking to Lamar and Mark earlier, and thanks for coming on, Lamar, and looking forward to talking to you again in a couple of days, and I want you to come back on, and there's some more stuff inside what you're saying there about how just how you saw the light come on, and that more and more people are figuring out that we're stronger together.
That's right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, take care. All right, it's been the Abolitionist Hour. And it's plus 1 hour.
1649, this St. George's Hill. A ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlords, they defied the laws. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. We come in peace, they said, to dig and sow. We come to work the land in common and to make the waste grounds grow. This earth divided, we will make whole. So it will be a common treasury for all. The sin of property we do disdain. No man has any right to buy and sell the earth for private gain. By theft and murder they took the land. Now everywhere the walls spring up at their command. They make the laws to chain us well. The clergy dazzle us with heaven, or they damn us into hell. We will not worship the God they serve, the God of greed who feeds the rich while poor folks starve.